Jessica, you are there?
Yes, I am here.
Okay. Well, let me, while you're loading your slides and hopefully working through the issues with WebEx, just thank our attendees for their patience and welcome everyone to another Thriving in Tough Times, with quotes this morning, a web briefing, a series of programs that Advantage has offered on organizational change. So it's nice to see many of you who have joined us again, and welcome to those of you who are with us for the first time. My name is John Hoskins, and I am the co-founder of Advantage Performance Group, and I'll be your host and master of ceremonies for today's webinar entitled Expand the Pie, Negotiating to Create Value. And the emphasis today that we'll have in our conversation between myself and Jessica, and hopefully yourselves, will be specifically slanted towards negotiation during what we're experiencing in terms of a global economic downturn. So roughly in 50 minutes, our speaker, and probably 40 minutes now, we're going to have to put you on fast forward there, Jessica.
Yeah.
We're going to provide some ideas to you about how your organization can have a more consistent approach to negotiation. And the key really is to understand how to create the best possible outcomes for both your company, the people inside your company, and outside your company with whom you are negotiating. So before I introduce our presenter in greater depth, let me cover just a few housekeeping items. In order to eliminate the background noise during Jessica's presentation, we're going to mute your lines. As time permits, we will open the phones to questions and answers at the end of the presentation. With regard to note-taking, as far as the slides are concerned, anything that you see on the slides will be provided to you through the Advantage partner in charge of your account. And finally, at the end, we'll also provide you with additional instructions on getting more information or more detail from Jessica about her presentation if you're looking to do something specific inside your company. So with that, let me take a moment now and just introduce in a little bit more detail our speaker. I'm very pleased this morning to be working with Jessica Notini. Jessica is a senior consultant at Accordance Incorporated, an alliance partner of Advantage. And this morning she's going to share with us really what's 15 years of negotiating expertise. And I really have just a ton of background information here on Jessica. She has a vitae that is very impressive, but maybe I'll point out a question and debate that I had with my son last night, which is she received her JD from the University of Michigan, where she graduated magna cum laude, but she was also awarded the Order of Coif. And so I'm going to ask the participants, does anyone know what the Order of Coif is? Well, see, I didn't either. There's quite a bit of history here. Wikipedia is probably the easiest way to get the history, but it's an honor society for law school graduates, and it's the student who earns a top 10% of his or her class. I was talking to Jessica about it this morning, and she said, it's not something I sought, it's something they gave me. So the argument is, does magna cum laude trump Order of Coif? And we'll leave that for debate later. But Jessica continues to teach around negotiation, mediation, and disputes. She works with law students and business students at Stanford, Bolt, Hastings, University of San Francisco Law School, and is also, interestingly, fluent in Spanish and has done a lot of work in South America, in Peru. So, Jessica, let me not blow your horn any longer. You're someone who's really expert, and we know you're going to provide us a lot of great insights this morning. So welcome.
Well, thank you, John. I really appreciate that introduction. And I'm happy to be with everybody here today now that we've overcome our technological difficulties. And I want to just give you a heads up that in our 40 or so minutes that we have together, I'm going to be covering a fair amount of ground. I think you'll leave at the end of our time with some very specific ideas about how to improve your mastery in negotiation. But I would really encourage you to take a lot of these concepts and explore them in more depth, because even just one single concept that I'm going to be dealing with today, I frequently spend 3 or 4 hours on when I, you know, when I have people in a workshop that's a week long or something like that. So let's get started.
Jessica, the thought that I have, though, kind of going in this to frame it is, you know, in tough times, would your experience say that people in general need to negotiate more, or you know, does it somehow highlight the negotiation skill when it seems like everyone's trying to get a better deal?
Yeah, well, I think people are certainly looking harder for more opportunities to negotiate. I guess what I would emphasize is, in this kind of climate, it's more important that you negotiate effectively. You really can't afford to just let some go because you didn't send the right person with the right skills. You need to make the deal opportunities that arise, you need to make them happen. So I really think it's a time to hone the skills. So I should start by just defining what I mean by negotiation and sort of common understanding. When I say negotiation, I mean any time, basically, I want something from you, you want something from me, or perhaps we both want something from each other. So really, we're negotiating, and all, I'm sure everybody who's on the line is negotiating all day, every day, about lots of things, from, you know, products to services to strategies to, you know, who's on which team and what kind of resources are you getting to support your team. So I'm going to move us through our slides a bit, I realize, as we begin this discussion. And I want to get us to the slide that discusses the map of the negotiation world of our participants. So as we can see here, you're negotiating internally within your group or your organization, as I said a second ago, might be who are the people who are on your team or the resources you've got. You're also negotiating externally with potential customers and partners, and you may also be negotiating with third parties, competitors, maybe agencies that have some regulatory power over you. So you negotiate in many different worlds. And then I like to, after discussing sort of the map of your negotiation world, move into what has been taught in negotiation for many years as sort of two primary approaches. The one that was historically predominant is the one you see here on the screen labeled adversarial. And I don't know, John, if you're familiar with that style. Many people, you may have read books, I'm just going to make up these names, but you might have heard something like, you know, top 10 tactics to crush your opponent, or how to get your way without them knowing what hit them. And this is the kind of approach where you've got people seeing the negotiation as something highly competitive, it's a win-lose situation, I'm going to go in there very carefully, guarded, you know, hang on to my information, because of course anything I might share with you, you could potentially use to take advantage of me. So tend to see more sort of tactics and negative leverage and viewing the other person as your opponent.
Isn't this more the transactional sale kind of thing, the used car salesperson?
Exactly. Or at least
really
that's
care. I mean, they're never going to see you again, so, you know, they don't care about the relationship, right?
I think you do tend to see that style even now in situations that are seen as, you know, one-time, high stakes, I don't care about relationship because I'm never going to see you again. But notice who you thought of. The used car sales people, perhaps you think of some hardcore insurance salespeople, and think about the reputation that these people have, and it's generally not great. And in fact, I think it's short-sighted, because even in those situations that you think may be one time, it's amazing how the world surprises us, and you end up finding that either your reputation has suffered because they've spread the word to everybody else, oh, don't go to that dealership, right? Or, you know, somebody might have been a repeat customer, but they're not going to be now because they didn't like the way they were treated.
Well, and in your work representing countries, countries are forever, so you can't really afford to, I guess we could pick places in history where the adversarial approach has taken place. But point made is that the collaborative is the direction you want us to head.
Definitely, and that at Accordance, that's really the primary focus. Our founder, Grand Lum, wrote the Negotiation Field book, and really the approach we're promoting in that book is the collaborative approach. And that's actually the negotiation literature and the teaching has really moved in that direction now for about 20 years. People might be familiar with the Harvard Negotiation Project, and Grand is actually a product of the Harvard Negotiation team, and he and many others like Fisher and Urey, getting to yes, getting past no. There's what they're really teaching is we find that we're much more successful and effective when we instead of viewing our counterpart negotiator as the opponent, see them as perhaps somebody on our team that we can work with together to solve a mutual problem. And can I get a lot of what I want and at the same time try to take care of you, make sure you're getting what you need? And let's not just... Yeah, John?
Well, I was just saying it's sort of like you're describing certain people. Grand is one of the nicest people I think I've ever met, and he personifies that collaborative approach. He walks and breathes it every day kind of thing. And so there's a high degree of trust, I think, when you're dealing with someone like that.
Yes, and I think that's one of the real benefits to a more collaborative approach is that you do tend to build relationship and build trust and liking with the people around you, which then leads to more future negotiations. People are happy to keep working with you because they know you're not just looking out for number one, you're looking out for them as well. And they also tend to be more satisfying negotiations, John, in the sense that we don't just kind of cut a money deal or stay at sort of the positional level. We'll be talking more about that in a minute. But we really dig down to what are the drivers, what's really important to people, and can we be creative and get resolutions that are much richer and satisfying in the end. So I like to start with just that beginning thought about moving in that collaborative direction while still recognizing that I think we do need to be aware of competitive strategies and prepared to use them at times when we're in a negotiation with somebody who may be coming more from that adversarial place. I like to say to some of my workshop participants, I don't want to send sheep out into the world either, right?
Gotcha.
So I'm going to move on to the next slide and talk a little bit about something that people usually find fascinating. And I wish we had more time because I really like to talk about each of these five more individual styles in great depth and really kind of help people understand what are the strengths and the weaknesses of each of those styles and what are the motivators behind it so that people, and I would actually encourage people, there are some personality assessments out there that you can get your hands on that will help you identify which style might be sort of your more... And usually people say to me, well, Jessica, though, I think I could be any one of those, and that's true. I think we can all move in and out of each of these five styles. But when you're in a conflict situation, and particularly under stress, what we find is people will tend to go to one or two sort of fallback styles. So it's interesting to sort of have a sense of what your fallback is, right? Learn to manage it, as well as come to understand styles you're less familiar with. It's not your style so much. So I'll just quickly identify a little bit about each of these five, so you have a sense of what they are. John, do you have a sense of what your fallback might be?
I'm not necessarily a conflict person, I may be a softy. I'm probably one of those who likes to split things down the middle.
Okay.
50-50 always sounds good to
50-50
me.
Sounds good. And, you know, that's interesting that you say that. And we do find that the style that's probably most frequently used in any place where there's an ongoing relationship, and that includes in the workplace, is the style you just identified, which is on here we're calling the compromising style. You know, a little bit for you, a little bit for me, let's meet in the middle. Their watchword, I say, is fairness. It just feels fair. Everybody gets something. We do like to distinguish that, though, from collaboration, where we're saying, you know, could we go past just 50-50? You know, are you maybe selling yourself short? Could you create more value? Could it be really all of what you want and all of what I want? Could we make this more successful for everybody? So, because one of the weaknesses of the compromisers, while it is very efficient and predictable and very effective in many situations, is that they may be stopping short. They may go too automatically to the middle ground. But let me get to the three other styles we haven't yet touched upon. On the vertical axis, you see that there's really a heavy emphasis on relationship and really wanting to take care of the other person. And so the person who is most accommodating is that person who's really saying, you can have this, I'll make the concessions. What I really want to do is take care of us getting along. And we sometimes also call these people the harmonizers. And of course, what they need to watch out for is over-accommodating, because then they're not taking care of enough of their other needs. Moving to the other axis, we see sort of the opposite, the horizontal here. We're really largely focused on substance or the goal, the transactional value in the deal. And the person who's maximally focused on this, and we're stereotyping a bit here, of course, is the person we call the competitor. Really wants to drive to goal and get things done. And when that's done really effectively, they're great people to have on your team because they know what the goal is and they're going to get you there and they can be very good leaders. Of course, their learning edge is that they need to rein that in a bit and remember to bring the people along with them because they may be sort of, I have a nickname for the ones who have not learned to manage that tendency and I call them the tanks. They run over relationships and pay a price along the way.
Now, wouldn't it be advisable then to not only kind of consider where you are coming from in this negotiation, but also consider where the person you're negotiating or organization you're negotiating with is coming from?
Exactly. You want to consider the pairings, right? So if you might have a tendency to be, very accommodating and trying to really move in a collaborative direction, but you know you're coming up against somebody who, at least by reputation, is highly competitive, you're going to need to watch out, right? You don't want to give away the store and have them just drive like a tank right over you. You're going to need to perhaps go in there a little stronger with more principles and a better, what we call a BATNA, alternative to your negotiated agreement with this potential person. But let me get to the last one here just so I leave people with some sense of all five. The one at the intersection of the two axes we call the avoider. And this really, I think, the easiest way to understand the style, I was sort of fascinated by this years ago because I didn't understand it myself very well. This person's fundamentally got a discomfort, typically, with conflict, and they tend to see negotiation as involving some edge to it, some conflict. So they'd really rather not go there if they don't have to. So in other words, they really just won't engage. They will neither take care of you, like the accommodator, nor will they really be asserting their own interests. They're just hoping it'll all take care of itself. And when they're doing that strategically and they're choosing their battles, as they like to put it, that can be very effective, right? Why make a mountain out of a molehill? The problem is the learning edge for avoiders is they kind of want everything to be a molehill, and so they may be avoiding when they shouldn't, when they really need to get in there and make a deal or take care of things before they get out of control.
Is this the classic passive-aggressive kind of
thing? That would be an avoider who has not learned to manage their tendency and on top of that, and these are the avoiders who really piss people off, right? They not only don't engage, they then go and do it their own way.
Okay.
Yeah, so you probably all run into a couple of those, and they it's interesting because in part they think they're taking care of relationship when they're doing what they're doing, but what they forget is especially if they're passive aggressive and they go do it their own way, they've got some pretty angry people around them after that.
Well, when you think of internal negotiation, which I hear a lot from clients today, in fact, one of our partners the other day said, we need a course to teach people how to negotiate internally. And because they go out to sell something, they bring it back in-house, and then they have to implement and deliver. And it strikes me as though when you hear about breakdown in teamwork or concerns with internal negotiation, it's that avoider, passive-aggressive type that really angers people.
Exactly. And really, so then you need training kind of on both sides, which is why I think it's really interesting to do this self-assessment. Because if you've got avoiders around you, you want to learn, sorry, I forgot to set when we were having technological difficulties. When you've got an avoider that you need to draw out, you want to have some tools for doing so, right? Understand their discomfort and try to help them feel like it's going to be a safe environment. And then you may also want training on the other side in sort of trying to teach that avoider to overcome that discomfort and see when it's worthwhile to jump in there and how to do so effectively.
Right. Well, this is good. I like this because it's contextual. I think a lot of negotiating programs that I'm familiar with don't speak to this, essentially. And so if you understand kind of where your innate feelings are about negotiation, maybe it helps you build a different skill.
Exactly. So, I really think that's a great place to start in any negotiation workshop is, you know, who are you, what's comfortable for you, what are your learning edges, right, and how do you work effectively with those around you who are different. But I do want to move on because I know we started a few minutes late, and we definitely have to get at least to this next slide, if not a number of the others. This, I often tell participants, we're now on the negotiation of interests rather than positions. If you only remember one thing from any negotiation workshop you ever do, this would be it. This is something that will change your life. You may already understand it intuitively, but you will become a much more masterful negotiator if you know how to use it very strategically, very consciously. So what do we mean? What's the difference between a position versus an interest? So as you can see here, we've got the slide that where we've given you a visual of an iceberg. So the position is like the tip of the iceberg. It's the demand, it's the strategy, it's the, you know, we have to do it this way. Whereas the interest is what's under the surface? What is your driver? What's your need, your concern, your motivator? And so how do we get there? And I think this is best understood by example. I another way I like to think about it is peeling away the layers of an onion. So at the very top layer of the onion is your demand, and probably a position that everybody's familiar with is a money position. You know, I need X number of dollars for a certain reason, for a product, or let's use an example of somebody going in and seeking a raise, let's say a $20,000 raise, just to put a number on it. And so you might ask yourself, well, why? Why are they asking for that? That's the question that kind of helps you dig down the layers. And I think of this as a mental muscle that you want to start exercising, and it's easiest to start exercising this mental muscle on yourself, right? Because you know you. You know, you can figure out what your motivators are. So, you know, ask yourself, John, why might you be asking for a $20,000 raise? What might be a motivator?
College tuition.
College tuition, yeah. So that's a layer down in the onion, right? And if I probe a little bit further, basically at the core of the onion, we get to sort of what I call the human need level, and that's where your most fundamental human need is. We all need to feel some economic security, financial security, right? So that's a financial driver. Can you imagine a different kind of driver, non-financial? Why somebody might ask for a $20,000 raise?
Maybe anticipating some change in their life, new baby arriving, something like that.
This is why you got to practice this mental muscle. So that, I think, is probably going towards finances again. You know, you're having a kid, you're going to have more bills, right? So I'll give you an example just to start expanding the thinking on this. I like people to think in several different categories, right? So not just the more, and I do think people tend to go exactly where you went, John, which is the more concrete, the financial, the I need food, shelter, clothing kind of stuff. But there are two other areas that are really pretty important and often overlooked, and then that can really take a negotiation downhill fast. So this employee that I'm imagining, it might be more psychological, right? Maybe they've been there a long time and they're not feeling appreciated or recognized. And so really they've just translated that feeling of lack of appreciation into a money demand, right? Or it may be what I call more of a procedural kind of interest, like, hey, it's just not fair. Everybody else in my department just got raises and I didn't. You know, so just as a matter of procedure and fairness and among folks in the department, I should be getting a raise. Is that starting to sort of expand?
Yeah, I guess the difference here, sure.
Yeah. So why do we say this is so important? Lots of reasons. First of all, hopefully as you were sort of thinking of that example I was sharing with you, you can imagine how it might give you more creative ideas, for solving the problem, right? Let's imagine the company has a cash flow problem. So I'm going to move to a slide in just a minute where I'm going to demonstrate what I'm talking about. But you tend to get more ideas. You tend to get better ideas. The quality of the conversation might change. You know, to use a different example, probably people are familiar with people going through a divorce and fighting over the kids, right? And at the position level, it's kind of all about who gets how much time. You know, 50-50 or nothing. You know, 90% for you. You can see them every other weekend, right? At the interest level, when you get those two parents talking to each other, more coming from their needs and concerns, you know, you hear a really different conversation. Like, well, I really love the kids, you know, and I, well, I love them too. And it's funny how often you find there are many shared interests, right? Well, I want to maintain a good relationship as a mom and or as a dad, right? Or I want to still be able to do these certain activities with my son or my daughter. And it just, you feel sort of a more connected quality to that, and it shifts it away from some of the adversarial tone that you're going to see more at the position level. So there's lots of reasons I encourage people to get down to that interest level. I'm going to show you, so on the next slide, we've got just a reminder of what the interests are, the needs and motivators. But as I said a second ago, I want to show you how this moves into better problem solving. And this is what we call expanding the pie. So here, you could imagine that blue circle represents the $20,000 raise that we were just talking about. And there's a tendency for people in negotiation to think that we call it fixed pie syndrome. There's just, that's all we got to talk about, just the $20,000. And a dollar more for you is a dollar less for me and vice versa. And that's a hard negotiation, right? Or just like that divorce negotiation, every percentage point more time for you is less for me. But the masterful negotiators dig down to those interests we just talked about and think, okay, now can we make this pie bigger? So now that we know, say, John, it's you seeking this raise, that you really feel not sufficiently appreciated and, you know, you really want some you want growth in the company and your reputation's really important to you, is there anything that I, as the company, might offer you other than money that you could imagine?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about this because a lot of times I think, as you imagine circumstances that we've all been in around interest, that some way they're more psychologically rewarding, that the psychic reward is more valuable than the monetary reward. So a new title, a different office, first class air travel, I mean, whatever it might be, the way in which people can make the pie bigger really requires a lot of creativity, I think.
Yeah, and that's the collaborative approach, right? Being more creative and potentially, I mean, let's say you do have some financial needs, right? You said your kid's going to college, but would you be just as happy or maybe happier with $10,000 raise, and maybe I can afford to give you that, and a much nicer office, and the better travel arrangements? Maybe I've got some benefits I can offer you, stock options, you know, that could be worth more in future, right when you need them.
How about tuition reimbursement? I mean, things that you may not have even thought of, right?
Exactly. And if we really took the time and didn't just jump to the compromise approach, right? Oh, okay, we'll just split the baby here, right? You might walk away with a piece of pie that means more to you than that entire $20,000 the concept that you started with, right? So that's what we're really encouraging people to do when we're moving into the collaborative approaches is get creative, make the negotiation richer, right? And in order to do so, as I said, yeah?
It's sort of like who puts the stuff on the table first. I think a lot of times people think, well, if I reveal all this, make my position in this negotiation less powerful, because then they'll know. I mean, I think particularly in sales, you know, salespeople struggle sometimes with the customer not revealing all of the issues that make them want to buy a particular product.
Because right.
Obviously, that customer wants the best price, and they may say something like, in their mind, well, if I make a bad decision here, I'll lose my job. But they're never going to say that to the salesperson.
Right. And to some extent, I think people will, well, a couple of thoughts come to mind. You know, when you get really good at exercising this mental muscle on yourself, First of all, you get better at drawing out that other person's interest, even when they're feeling a little guarded. But we're just guessing. You know, you get really good at guessing what their motivators are. And even if they don't say them explicitly, you can then strategize to meet what you're pretty sure are their underlying interests. And that's actually a good segue to our next slide. I also like to talk to people about sort of managing the tension, because I think you're kind of aiming right at that tension, John, that we have in almost any negotiation, which is, you know, on the one hand, I want to be revealing enough of what's important to me so that I can do this work. That's what we're calling here on the slide, the integrative bargaining or the creation of value, expanding the pie. But at the same time, I'm a little worried because I know ultimately we have to cut the pie, right? We've got to figure out which piece I get, which piece you get. That's the distributive bargaining. And this is what we call the negotiator's dilemma. You know, how do I behave collaboratively enough to do the creation piece while still competitively enough to do the distribution piece? And I think going back to what you just said, John, you know, you need to be careful, right? You wouldn't want to go in there and just lay all your cards on the table right away and say, here, bear my soul, here, now, hopefully you'll treat me right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like the metaphor of expand the pie versus cut the pie. That's something I'd never heard Grant talk about before, but I like the, it's very clear when you think of it. Even when you ask me my style, and I said it was more, you know, down the middle, I thought about, you know, birthdays and sitting, a family of five and five kids cutting the pie or cutting anything, really. You know, it was always sort of like equal pieces for all the kids, but no one ever thought about putting other things on the table, right?
Right.
Which is a great metaphor.
Yeah.
So we've got interests in this model, and I'm wondering if you should describe the diamond in its context. Is this is your fundamental core principle within the
that's thing. Yeah, and let me actually, while we'll do that, I'll just move to the next one, and at the end of our talk today, you'll see we have all four components of the ICON value diamond, and this is what accordance, the way we like to organize people's thinking about negotiation so that they can be more conscious and strategic. And so we've now hit on the first component, interests, and we're moving into the second component, options. So when we did our pie expansion just a second ago, and we talked about all those things we could do, you know, other than or in addition to money, those were options, possible solutions to satisfy the interest, right? And the remaining two components that we'll see in just a few minutes are criteria, how are we going to evaluate those options, and then what if at some point we might want to consider, well, is this deal good enough? What's my no agreement alternative? You know, so that employee I was just talking about, at some point they might say, well, you know, I don't think you're treating me well enough. Maybe I want to go get a job somewhere else. That might be their no agreement alternative, right? But taking it just one step at a time, I want to focus in on options and add to what we said just a second ago. I think sometimes people think, well, or they struggle with how to do that. How do we generate the options? And I find there's two things that really help them improve. One is timing. I find that in many, and I'm mediating a lot, so that's, I've got people who are, you know, in conflict, and they arrive at my offices, and I'm surprised sometimes how quickly they just want to dive in. Well, I know how to solve this problem. And I'm thinking, well, if it was that simple, why did you end up here with me, right? You'd think you would have had it solved before, right? And this is a common human tendency. We want to make it right, but we dive into the option generation too soon, before we've really gotten the interest and before we've taken care of relationship or understanding the people in the room and building some rapport. You know, none of that's been done, and people are already diving into solutions, right? So you can imagine the kinds of solutions that get generated too early, right? Highly positional, more adversarial, and you're going to tend to hit impasse more often than not. So what I like to say is just hold off, as well as then maybe think about your method. Are you going to put ideas out yourself? Are you going to ask them for ideas? Or are you going to maybe use some process where you generate ideas together? And I really like that last one, because I find that when you get the sort of the collaborative, we're a team working up on the issue, and I like physically to put the issue up on the board. What's the problem-solving area? You know, how do we make you, John, feel validated and appreciated as an employee? You know, we'll put that up on the board, and we'll throw up our ideas together. And, you know, I will caution people about just throwing out their own ideas in a negotiation, no matter how excited they are, and particularly if there's maybe more of a conflict edge, because what we do find is that there's a tendency for what we call reactive devaluation. So, John, I don't know if you probably have never heard of that phrase before. You still there, John?
Yes.
Well,
just,
let me...
You were cut short. I think you want to just repeat that last...
Yeah, sorry, because I couldn't hear you, and I thought suddenly we had a technical problem again. So reactive devaluation is basically saying, you know, any idea you have, John, is probably a bad idea. Because you're not looking out, especially if it's a more competitive negotiation, right? My assumption is you're not looking out for me. You're looking out for you, right? So by definition, anything you suggest is probably a bad idea. So I often counsel people that they may be better off kind of trying to find a way to getting the other side to suggest their favorite idea, right? Or use a technique such as brainstorming. And I imagine most people are familiar with brainstorming, but where I see them make mistakes with that is not really laying it out clearly what are the rules, right? Like, you got to say, all ideas go up, no matter how zany. Even the craziest idea might be the seed for something that'll work. No, absolutely no evaluation or criticism during option generation, because the minute I say, oh, John, that idea sucks, you know, how likely are you to put any more on the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or that'll never work, you know. It just shuts down the creativity.
So we have the world of interests and all the things that are possible in terms of satisfying my situation or understanding my situation. Then we have all these possibilities.
Exactly.
How to relate what we could do to those interests. Then you move to, okay, objective criteria, which is what?
Objective criteria. So here we are now at the third element in the ICON diamond. These are standards, benchmarks, norms in the industry. Using an example that everybody would be familiar with, if you were, say, you were selling a house, right? How would you pick the price for selling the house? And persuade me that it was a good price. So you wouldn't probably say to me, John, oh, you know, I want $1 million because that's a really nice number and that would be really helpful to me in buying my next house, right? You'd want to have something that seemed principled. This is the whole point of using objective precedents or standards, something that stands outside of you, right, that you can reference. And so the obvious in the house example is we need to determine fair market value, right? And we've got a couple of ways we could do that. We could, you know, get a real estate agent to look at the comparables. We could bring in an appraiser. Of course, you and I might then get into a negotiation over which way is better, you know, which standard is better, and you as the seller might prefer the real estate agent's standard because they're going to tend to give you a higher price because they're trying to get
right.
your business, whereas I might prefer the appraiser's standard, assessment of fair market value, because they're going to come in usually with a more conservative evaluation that protects the financial institution.
So back to the salary issue, what would be an example there?
So salary,
range is at the organization that we have to abide by, and we can't go beyond the range.
Yeah, so that would be a great standard for the organization. You know, we need to be consistent and fair, and here's our range, and we can't pay you more than we pay other people in the same position. Of course, I might come back with, well, but, you know, the norm in other similar companies that I've been looking at that I'm seeing is 10% higher. That's a standard too, right? So the standards are very helpful. They give you backbone in your negotiation, but I like to alert people that's not the end of discussion. You're gonna have to anticipate that you're sometimes gonna have a negotiation over which is the more relevant and appropriate criteria to apply here.
I already know I don't want to negotiate with you, Jessica.
Well, I always have the best standards. Actually, though, you know, a piece of wisdom: if you can figure out what standards they're gonna be using and work within their standards rather than having a fight over which one, that can be a wise strategy.
Okay, so now I'm having a conversation really across all three of these parts of your diamond, the interests, the positions, or the interests, the criteria are used to sort of evaluate what the possible satisfiers are.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And And I'm going to just quickly mention this next slide. There's not time to go into it in depth, but I also advise people when they're planning for a negotiation, think ahead of time what you're striving for. What's your target? What's your best possible agreement? You know, I could get $1.2 million for this house. Make it specific. Don't just say I want to get the most possible. Make it specific. It's hard to hit a target if you don't have one, right? So I want $1.2 million and make it justifiable. And that's where the criteria come in again, right? I've seen some comps that look a lot like my house, and I'm pretty sure it may be optimistic, but I can justify that 1.2. At the same time, you want to know your walk away or your no agreement. You want to look at your no agreement alternative. At what point do I prefer not to sell that house at all? I have a different buyer who would give me, you know, more than you're offering me, or I just assume not sell the house at all and wait for the market to come back because, you know, I'm not going to recoup my investment in this house. So I want to also know my bottom line so that I don't make a bad deal. Strive for the target, but have as a parameter also, you know, at what point do you prefer no deal? And then we move into that sort of segues us into our last component of the ICON value diamond, what is my no agreement alternative? And this is where I think where people can usually significantly improve their mastery as negotiators is by getting better at assessing the no agreement alternative. A lot of my clients I find are sort of imagining, well, you know, I'm pretty sure somebody would give me at least $1 million for this house. But they haven't done the research to back that up. They haven't really looked at, you know, is it a buyer or a seller's market? Is it, you know, how many people are looking in this neighborhood? They just haven't done their research to back that up. So what I encourage people to do, and I'll use a different example, so I have clients in mediation who their no agreement alternative is typically I'm going to court, right? And I've got maybe a client who's imagining, oh, well, I'm going to get $100,000 if I go to court. But then when I really sit down with the client and the attorney and I say, well, okay, so $100,000at the end of the day, and I ask the attorney a couple questions, how much is that going to cost you? Oh, well, you know, $50,000 in attorney's fees. So what people are routinely failing to factor in is the costs. And I don't mean just monetary. I mean monetary and non-monetary. So the client might not be factoring in that that's cost $50,000 to get there, and it's 2 years away from now, and it's a lot of stress and depositions and, you know, repeating of the conflict, and they're just not accounting for all that. That it's $100,000 minus $50,000 for a walk-away of $50,000, and the last thing they're not accounting for is, what's the probability of that? So the attorney's been saying something like, oh, yeah, we have a good case, and I say, well, what does that mean? And the attorney says, well, you know, I'd say that's a 50-50 shot. Well, you can imagine the client's eyes opening, right? 50-50? that means that $50,000 is not worth $50,000, right? So suddenly I have them sort of reevaluating if there was maybe a $40,000 settlement offer on the table that they didn't think looked good. Once we've gone through a really detailed no agreement alternatives analysis, their eyes are open, right? And they're making a more intelligent decision.
This is a way that you're suggesting that people navigate through the conversation, which creates the most value and makes people more collaborative than some of the other styles that you referenced earlier.
Exactly. More collaborative and just more intelligent, right? You know, so once you've looked at your no agreement alternatives, and we put these in the diamond because they really all flow into and out of each other, right? Your no agreement alternative actually, in some senses, becomes a criteria. And it, as they look at each of those, they might get more clear on their interests. And as they get clear on all three of those, they might go back to the drawing board on the options and think, well, I didn't like my no agreement alternative so much. Maybe we should work harder and get more creative here.
It also strikes me as though this could be a very useful tool for planning.
Exactly,
in other words,
exactly.
Rather than going in cold, you could take this concept itself as buckets and say, well, what do I think the interests might be, options, criteria, and that.
Yes, and I sometimes go, you know, when people got a really serious, I've worked with people, say, who had collective bargaining coming up, and we go through all of these before they walk in that door. You know, keeping in mind, though, that as you walk into the actual negotiation, you know, you shouldn't have your ideas set in stone. You know, you go in and you explore and you find out if your guesses were correct, right? But it's a very useful planning tool.
One of the things that, this is sort of a summary slide, right?
Right here.
Maybe I'll let you clear this slide, and then I have a few questions I'd like to ask you.
Okay. So this slide basically just puts together what we just ran through, right? That as you walk into a negotiation, you're seeking both to discover their interests and carefully share yours gradually, making sure you got some reciprocity going on. If that's all going well and you feel like you've got a foundation, you move into option generation. You then apply the criteria to evaluate the options, right? Which ones look good based on the standards and norms. And you apply the interest, right? Which options are best satisfying everybody's interests. And then at some point you may compare what you got on the table, what seems to be developing, to your agreement alternatives. Is this good enough, better enough, so that you can do this last piece, decide. Do I have something that's my best possible agreement or close enough to it? Or do I go to my, what's called here, the BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, or what we at Accordance are calling your no agreement alternative. So that's just the kind of the summary of what we've just talked through.
Well, some of the examples we used this morning have been more personal examples, and I think the participants on the phone, a lot of them are responsible for the development of their organization's negotiation culture, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple thoughts come to mind, and you've probably dealt with these kinds of things, particularly in your government work. But you have these organizations like Walmart, who are sort of, I don't think they're on the phone this morning, but there's
I'll be careful just in case.
They're notorious for beating up their suppliers on price. And, you know, how does somebody deal with that 1,000-pound gorilla who you just know, you know, is going to come at you with, the most difficult, propositions?
You know, you would ask me the toughest question. I knew you would ask that one. There are a lot of smart people thinking about that one, and I don't want to give people false hope that there's one perfect way that you could deal with that. Clearly, I'm kind of using this to segue into the last slide here, prepare for any negotiation you've got with a 1,000-pound gorilla. Have your standards, have everything lined up so that you've got backbone going into that negotiation. But honestly, you know, that negotiation is going to depend. The real question is, why is that a 1,000-pound gorilla? And what's happened, I think, is they may have become the only game in town. And if they've become the only game in town, what that means is you don't have a no-agreement alternative, right? Or your no-agreement alternative is very bad. So what can you do about that? Can you improve your no-agreement alternative? You know, could you say, if your suppliers that Walmart is beating up on, trying to really get what you're supplying for minimal value, can you in some way coordinate or unite with each other so that they can't play you off each other? Can you generate support in the surrounding community so that they come to you, so that you improve your own no-agreement alternative? People come to you because they don't want Walmart to be the only game in town, and they're willing to pay a price for that. But it's really, I think it's largely about improving your own no-agreement alternative and trying to make their no-agreement alternative worse. But you may not always be able to do that, honestly.
Now, with respect to strategy and negotiation, the one I recall is when the United States and Vietnam were negotiations to end that war, the U.S. went to Paris and were in hotel rooms, and the Vietnamese went there and had two-year leases on apartments. You know, it struck me as a great strategy to say, you know, we're here for a long talk. We're not here for
Yeah, it certainly sends a signal, doesn't it?
Yeah. So what are some of the, you know, the greatest examples in your mind of good negotiation strategy?
You know, when people say strategy, often what that brings to my mind is the idea of tactics. And I don't know if I'm going to say these are good, but they work, right? So playing, it really comes down to playing on the human psychology. So, for example, in terms of survival, a couple of things that we're all familiar with, if there's any sense of urgency or scarcity, that really triggers something in us. So the minute you say, this is the last one in stock, or one day, last day sale before prices go up, it's almost this Pavlovian, you know, you feel your heartbeat starting to race, I've got to have it, right? And if you can play upon that, but you have to do this so that people don't feel like they're being played, because people react to the tactics when they feel like they're heavy-handed maybe all of us been at some point in a timeshare presentation. That's a great display of almost every tactic imaginable. But one of my favorites is reciprocity. that might be a good note to end on. And I think this is really based, again, in human survival. Like, if you take care of me in my time of need, I feel sort of compelled to help you in your time of need. And this really has helped with the persistence of the human race, really. And so you see people use this all the time, right? You know, Turkish rug dealer, you sit down, you have some tea, they give you a lot of time and attention, and you feel as they do all these things for you, and they're small, but they're little gifts. You feel building in you sort of a sense of commitment to making a purchase, right? Almost like you owe it to them. So people are playing on reciprocity all the time.
Sure. We do have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if we should.
Yeah, you want me to unmute?
I think so. *7, I think, is your key. And I'm going to ask Carol Bunn.
I just turned conversation mode on.
Okay, Carol, can we hear you? Carol?
Yes, I just took myself off mute. Hear me?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Okay, so we've got the lines open. Would anyone like to pose a question to Jessica while we have her online? That includes Steve or Carol or?
It's a quiet group.
Quiet group.
Jessica, it's Carol Bynum. Perhaps start us with a question. When you are really in a negotiation conversation, and you are at the point in the meeting or the conversation that you would like to establish that conversation around interest, do you have a leading open-ended question that you find is a good conversation starter around the subject of interest?
Yeah, I actually have a number of them, and that's a good question because I think the temptation is to ask a why question. You know, why do you want this? Why? And you can use the word why, but it could create a defensive reaction. You know, like I have to justify to you why I'm asking for what I'm asking for. So I like to ask more questions like, can you tell me where that idea is coming from? Or can you explain to me what's important to you about this proposal? Or what would it mean to you if we did it this way? So I have about 5 different ways of asking the question. You know, what would it mean to you? What's important to you? You know, what would that achieve for you? Yeah, I could use the word interest. What interest would that satisfy? Is that answering your question?
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Those are good starters.
Hi, this is Greg Lombard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just curious, when you go into a negotiation, one thing you didn't touch on was the style of the person that you're negotiating with. I think it's very important to understand the style of that person, be it analytical, be it very quiet and reserved, and to recognize what style you're actually negotiating with, and to then match your style to that style so that you don't go in there and try to overburden the person with just style.
That's a great comment, and it goes, and you're sort of expanding style definition beyond the 5 styles we looked at, and I think that's really a good, that's very appropriate. And your point is, and I sometimes say it's like you want to dial into their telephone number, and to the extent you can sort of match them in some ways, you're speaking their language, right? And they're going to tend to like you better. And when you like somebody better, you tend to give them more of what they want, right? So anytime you can sort of seem similar and develop liking and do that by being as they are, you know, if they're quick-paced and analytical, kind of trying to go along with that. While at the same time, you know, you don't want to be so far different from your own style and comfort zone that you're not coming across as authentic. But it's a great idea.
Thank you. And one other question I have, if nobody else has a question, I'm in the middle of a negotiation right now where we are just simply miles apart. The need and the expectation of the customer doesn't come close to what the need and the expectation is of my organization.
Right.
So building on the open-ended questions, and I've got a meeting set up with them next week, what would you feel would be the best way to start the dialogue to getting closer to where both parties need to be?
Well, sometimes, I mean, I think just identifying where you're, what is the problem? Let's look at this. We are miles apart. Can you help me understand why? Might be a good starting question. what's going to, I guess without knowing more about the situation, it's hard for me to give you a lot of ideas, but what are the no agreement alternatives? You know, are they appropriately miles away from you because they have an alternative that looks good to them? Same question for you?
No, they don't have a real good alternative.
Okay. So your sense is that they are going to probably need to come towards you, and if they don't, they're going to be just out of luck because they don't have a no agreement alternative.
That's correct.
Right. So and I want to be careful with this, right? But at some point, you'd kind of like to educate them on that, right? The danger with educating them on how bad their no agreement alternative is because it could start sounding like a threat, right? It's what we call negative leverage, right? But the best negotiators know how to reference the negative leverage carefully. You know, boy, we would hate to see that happen, and, you know, that's the last thing we want here, you know. So let's try to get back to how do we close this gap and think creatively about what would close the gap. But you might need to bring that negative leverage in there in a subtle way. I don't know if that's helping or if
a
I'm
soft hammer.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
Greg,
you know,
this is John. It's interesting sometimes, Greg. It's even this economy has brought more requests from our clients to do negotiations training. And one of the pauses we frequently have with that is it a matter of them not being good negotiators? Or is it a matter of them not selling value to the customer? And so it's kind of, to me, these two areas of sales negotiation are very intertwined. And the question kind of becomes, Jessica, is when does the negotiation begin and when does the selling stop, you know? Or
right.
Are they so intertwined that you're really negotiating from the first call?
Yeah, I think you're negotiating all the time and from the first call. And I don't even know... I mean, I don't like it to stop. In fact, I often am trying to create face-saving ways back to the table, right? So it's not working today. We couldn't close that gap today. But, you know, use language like, well, not yet, not today. You know, I'm going to go do some more research or, you know, give people excuses, whether it's time, getting more authority, doing some research on their alternatives or the standards, but find a way both for you to get back to the table and for them another day in hopes that, you know, you will pull it together ultimately.
Good luck with that, Greg.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
So perhaps, John, we should...
Last slide, sure, and I'll
clear
that for you.
So the optimizing negotiations, we've really talked all through that, so I'll just pull us up to the last slide here, the call to action, and I think that's for you to discuss, John.
Well, Jessica, first of all, let me thank you so much for taking the time, and I'm sorry you had difficulty with the WebEx stuff this morning, but it seems like you've captured the attention of the audience and kept most people here. We'd like to offer attendees the opportunity to receive a copy of the slide deck, and again, you can ask your Advantage partner in charge of your account. If you don't know who that is, feel free to give me a call at 480-235-5582, and I can direct you to the right person or help you get what you need. And then if you'd like to receive a copy of the Negotiation Field Book, which is authored by Grant Lum, the founder of Accordance, that we would like to make available to you as well. And following that, if you'd like to have a consultation call with Jessica to discuss negotiation strategy, you're welcome to request that as well. So thank you all for joining us this morning. And again, Jessica, very informative. Loved working with you. You're a real subject matter expert that I will be a go-to person for me now. I can add to my Grant Lum group of people that you call when you have a tough negotiation.
Great. Well, I appreciate that, John, and it was great working with you as well.
Pleasure.
And thanks for all the good questions.
Have a great day, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.